Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, a rigged election in Kenya at the end of December plunged that country into chaos and violence, occasioning a too familiar view of the continent from U.S. media that explained very little about the roots of the crisis. NYU professor and Kenya comment blogger Tavia Nyong'o will join us to talk about that. Also on the show, the press corps had a chance to use a strategy story to talk about a real issue, with the recent back and forth between the Obama and Clinton campaigns about a mailer on health care. But our guest says most took a pass, leaving voters no better informed than before. We'll hear from journalist and author Trudy Lieberman on what media might have done with Harry and Louise. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
The big surprise on Super Tuesday, according to corporate media, was Mike Huckabee's strong showing in southern states. As the New York Times reported on the Wednesday morning after, Huckabee, quote, revived his candidacy with victories across the South, close quote. Actually, though, Huckabee did about as well as one could have predicted. He was running close to Mitt Romney in national polls, and he had come in a close second to John McCain in South Carolina just 10 days before Super Tuesday. But campaign reporters, in love with the trope of a two-person race, had essentially written Huckabee out of the story. On the rare occasions when he was covered, it was often disdainfully. The Washington Post described him as desperate to stay relevant. Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC noted that Huckabee was stealing votes from Mitt Romney and asked, why is he still running? The media devoted most of their coverage of the Republican race to John McCain, and almost all of what was left over to Romney. A study by the Project for Excellence in Journalism found that in the week before Super Tuesday, McCain got 18 times as much coverage as Huckabee, while Romney got 10 times as much. Even Rudy Giuliani dropping out of the race got 7 times more coverage than Huckabee. Huckabee almost didn't exist, as far as corporate media were concerned. No wonder they were surprised to find him winning 5 states and more delegates than Mitt Romney.
In the run-up to the 2004 presidential election, the National Journal magazine unveiled a study that found John Kerry was the most liberal senator. That ultra-liberal designation became a regular feature of commentary about Kerry's campaign. The magazine just unveiled its rankings for this year, and wouldn't you know it, the winner was another Democratic presidential contender, Barack Obama. And just like 2004, the magazine's ranking became big news, even though few reporters or pundits bothered to look into its curious methodology. But anyone might find the ranking a bit odd. Is Obama really more liberal than, say, Russ Feingold or independent socialist Bernie Sanders? The magazine gets there by a complex process that considers only certain votes in certain categories, weights some of those votes to make them more important, and then decides what the liberal or conservative position would be. Looking at the actual votes, Obama, ranked number 1, and Hillary Clinton, ranked number 16, differed exactly twice. For example, on the matter of establishing an Office of Senate Integrity, Obama voted yes and Clinton no. Supporting that Joe Lieberman amendment was taking the liberal position, according to the National Journal. Their votes also differed on an immigration amendment. There are other rankings, like VoteView, that found Obama around the 10th most liberal Democrat, with Clinton somewhat further to his right. That would seem to make a lot more sense, and that's in line with other vote rankings. But none of those others get nearly as much attention as those from the Beltway publication, the National Journal. If he is the eventual nominee, expect to hear the Obama is the most liberal line often in the press, but don't expect many reporters to explain it.
Some articles just make you scratch your head, like one in the February 4th Los Angeles Times with the unpromising headline, "Too Many Asians, the U.S. Electoral System is a Mystery." The piece was patronizing in its specifics. The lead actually said that many Asians are confused because U.S. candidates have strange names. And in general, in purporting to tell any kind of meaningful story by glossing the political opinion of various different countries with lines like, "In Indonesia, it's all Barack Obama," and "There's little love lost in many sake bars for Clinton." The story didn't even bear out its goofy headline, since none of the Asians quoted appeared to have been asked about the U.S. electoral system at all, and their comments on the candidates didn't suggest very much mystery. The mystery is why the Times should run such a silly piece, perhaps especially given that there is a story to be told about how many Americans rightful confusion and concern around the U.S. electoral system.
The New York Times' Michael Barbaro turned in another love note to Walmart February 3rd, headlined "Walmart, the New Washington." This one was about how the giant corporation now sees itself as less like a business and more like a government. Quote, "bursting through political log jams and offering big picture solutions to intractable problems," close quote. Like other Times pieces, the article cites Walmart's record of labor and environmental problems as a thing of the past, and in this case as a source of what the reporter calls epiphanies on the company's part. Epiphanies that, quote, encouraged Walmart to think bigger. If the company was such an effective problem solver, more effective at times than the federal government, why not tackle the big issues of the day? Close quote. Well, there is serious reporting to be done on the privatization of state functions. But such reporting wouldn't provide just a single paragraph for criticism, followed up by the reporter's rejoinder, "Still, it's hard to argue with results." Nor would it parrot corporate PR, noting matter-of-factly how a Walmart VP, quote, explained that 90% of Americans shop at Walmart and that among them, Walmart's favorability ratings are 91%, close quote. A little checking found a Pew poll that said that 91% of Americans live near a Walmart. Maybe that's what they meant. The same poll found the store had a 31% unfavorable rating, which they noted was considerably higher than that for many other major corporations. And really, if Walmart were so universally beloved, seen by all as they are by the Times as having transformed from a laggard to a leader on issues like healthcare and the environment, it's hard to see why they'd need to undertake such a strenuous PR effort.
And finally, Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly is at it again, and by it, we mean lying. On January 4th, he mocked John Edwards for talking about homeless veterans. Here's a clip.
As for John Edwards, good grief, this guy has no clue.
And tonight, 200,000 men and women who wore our uniform proudly and served this country courageously as veterans will go to sleep under bridges and on grates. We're better than this.
That was Edwards' concession speech last night. I mean, come on. The only thing sleeping under a bridge is that guy's brain.
Well, this story continued for several weeks. O'Reilly cracked jokes about how he was still looking for all the veterans sleeping under the bridges. He said he'd happily help these non-existent vets by taking them to sleep at John Edwards' house. Then O'Reilly offered up a new defense. Edwards had blamed the economy for this homelessness problem, which is inaccurate. O'Reilly blames the vets themselves for their psychological or addiction problems. When a viewer wrote to O'Reilly to point out that Edwards didn't blame the economy, per se, O'Reilly said the viewer was, quote, either deaf or stupid, close quote. Well, activists led by OutFox producer Robert Greenwald decided to take the argument directly to Fox News, arranging a protest of homeless vets outside the network's headquarters. On February 1st, O'Reilly aired his response, which actually consisted of an O'Reilly producer demanding to know if the vets had seen O'Reilly's original comments firsthand. It's hard to know what's worse, ridiculing the discussion of homeless veterans and questioning their existence, or confronting some of those vets and trying to expose them for not being loyal watchers of your cable television show.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
The news out of Kenya this year has been bleak, to put it mildly. Rigged election returns sparked waves of violence that have so far claimed 1,000 lives. Hundreds of thousands of Kenyans have fled their homes. Well, violence and mayhem in Africa is almost a mainstream media template by now, and the images we've seen so far have conveyed a familiar, though still shocking, message. Well, what are the layers to this story that are harder to locate in the corporate press? And is the conventional framing of the Kenya story, a clash between ethno-tribes, even accurate? Joining us now to discuss this issue is Tavia Nyong'o. He is a cultural historian and an assistant professor of performance studies at New York University. He writes the blog Kenya Comment. Tavia Nyong'o, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Well, let's assume that most people have only a passing understanding of the immediate context here, so we'll start quickly with that, the election at the end of December. Tell us very briefly what happened.
Well, I was in Kenya at the time, and the consensus, which I can certainly affirm, is that the election leading up to it was very free and fair. There was widespread campaigning on all sides, and the actual voting process was remarkably transparent. The problem came in the count of the vote at the central headquarters in Nairobi, and many outside observers, including the EU, found that the Electoral Commission of Kenya rigged the results in favor of the incumbent Kibaki.
Now, what happened in the aftermath of that is what I guess most people are probably familiar with a few exceptions. This violence has been understood or framed as a clash of tribes, really, Kibakis on one hand and the oppositions on the other hand. Do you think that's an adequate explanation or anywhere near accurate?
I don't. And increasingly, people in the U.S. are coming to see that the ethnic clash story is actually, in the words of Donald Payne, who's the representative from New Jersey, plays right into the hands of the Kibaki camp because it makes the politically triggered unrest in Kenya seem like ethnic violence. In fact, Kenya has a history of ethnic violence in the lead up to and during elections from the 90s. And having said that, the violence which was triggered by the election has gone on to take a life of its own. But it's important not to equate the situation in Kenya with the situation in Rwanda, which I think is the immediate comparison that most onlookers would draw, that people are fighting each other because of their ethnic differences. In fact, as most Kenyans recognize, violence is being triggered by the conflict in the election and also increasingly by historic injustices that are being now exposed, injustices that go back to really to the independence era. But it's not tribe-on-tribe violence, and that perception is really making it more difficult to find a political solution to the crisis.
I know one thing that you wrote, commented about how CNN was trying to explain this to viewers as a majority tribe and a minority tribe in Kenya sort of clashing again. And from what it sounds like, there are probably dozens of different tribes in Kenya.
There are at least a dozen major tribes and dozens more smaller tribes. There is no ethnic majority or minority in Kenya. There is a plurality of one ethnicity and many others. And the reality is that any governing coalition in Kenya must be a cross-ethnic coalition. So the violence which has, in the fallout of the election, taken on ethnic characteristics and certainly been kind of fomented by people on all sides who really do need to be held to account for their actions during this crisis is a very different thing than saying there's a kind of systemic and historical enmity between tribes in Kenya, which has really not historically been the case. People have lived side by side peaceably for 40, 50 years and can do so again in the future. There's a lot of intermarriage and people able to own land and own businesses in different parts of the country. A lot of that's unraveling now because of the prolongation of this crisis and because the government is seen to be illegitimate. And in order to restore Kenya to its state of multicultural harmony, we're going to need to get a political solution that's recognized as legitimate by all sides. One of the key problems Kenya has is a very winner-take-all political system where whoever is first past the post into the presidency controls the government, controls the courts, controls the police, controls the Electoral Commission, and controls the economy. So the actions that the Kibaki administration has taken since the election has really exacerbated the perception of those who feel left out by naming a cabinet, by describing himself as the duly elected president, by making these kinds of actions that are standing in the way of a political resolution that would be seen as legitimate by all sides. That's part of what's prolonging this ethnic conflict. But ethnicity is not the cause of the conflict, nor is it really the trigger. The trigger is the disputed election.
Now, there were comparisons to Rwanda, and one of the interesting things is that there have been reports of incitements to violence on Kenyan radio, but it seems like the differences are more important, that the government has tried to issue advertisements to the Kenyan media that would disparage their opposition, and the Kenyan media, as far as I can tell so far, have been refusing to play this game. So it would seem to be a very important distinction from what happened in Rwanda. There's often a link between the way U.S. media cover an international crisis like this and U.S. interests in a particular country or a region. Has the United States government weighed in on this in any real sense? Are we observers, or are we something more to this?
The U.S. has weighed in, and again, in the words of Donald Payne, the U.S. response to date has been counterproductive and one-sided. I think we're beginning to see the other side now that hearings are occurring in the House and in the Senate. This House just passed a resolution that will go some ways to helping get the U.S. on the right side of this conflict. But the initial response, which was to congratulate Kibaki for the running of the election and really implying that it would be business as usual, when no one else in the international community was doing that, really was a gaffe and played right into the hands of the Kibaki camp.
There were early reports that seemed sort of shocked at the violence in the aftermath of the disputed election because Kenya was seen as a model of something like stability. Those are the words that you heard, or the term you heard over and over again. But what it did seem was that this was exposing something that was very deep, almost a class conflict in Kenya. Is that right? Or
there is a real class conflict in Kenya, and it really is a situation of neocolonialism in which there's a dual economy, and the growth that Kenya has seen in the last 5 years has really benefited those in that top-tier international economy who've seen enjoyed the fruits of that growth. But the underclass in Kenya has been left out, and there's a great deal of anger and resentment towards that situation. The class conflict also has a kind of generational component to it in that Kenya is a very young society. 60% of Kenyans are between the ages 18 and 30. That's not including people under the age of 18. On the other hand, we have people like the president who's been in parliament since independence in 63. So across the spectrum of Kenyan institutions, there's this perception that an old guard, which enjoyed the fruits of independence and really was able to, through kind of cronyism and corruption, attain masses and masses of wealth, are now standing in the way of both the poor and the young. And much of the violence, which began as political and then took on ethnic characteristics and is now taking on, frankly, criminal components, you know, people with criminal opportunism in terms of literally highway robbery as you try to move from one city to the next, that reflects the despair of people left out of the Kenyan economy.
Now, often with situations like this, we talk about where people can get the story elsewhere outside the U.S. media. I know you singled out The Economist for being a bit better than the rest. What else can people do? Is Kenyan media available to people?
Kenyan media is widely available, and this is one of the ways in which the situation differs from Rwanda. Kenya is a much more developed society than Rwanda was in 94, and there are at least four Kenyan radio stations that are simulcast on the internet 24 hours. The Kenyan diaspora has been getting information from those radio stations and from, you know, there's Kenyan newscasts, which are uploaded onto YouTube periodically. Nation TV, which is a Kenyan radio station, has its own YouTube channel. So because of the internet, there's been much greater amount of information available through vehicles like the blogosphere. Kenyan bloggers have been sending information in from all these different cities. So it's very possible to get the Kenyan view of the situation in the country, and in many cases that there's still this question of corporate media in Kenya, unfortunately, so you can't simply say because it's Kenyan, it's therefore a more accurate depiction of the situation. But one can at least see what's happening on the ground in Kenya in addition to what's available through, you know, CNN and the BBC.
We've been speaking to Tavia Nyongo. He's a cultural historian and an assistant professor of performance studies at New York University. He writes the blog Kenya Comment. You can find that link from the Counterspin page at FAIR's website. Tavia Nyongo, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Are journalists so caught up in handicapping the presidential race that they've completely forgotten the idea of talking about issues? An opportunity was largely missed recently during a several-day back and forth between leading Democratic candidates Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton about health care. The press got the strategic story about the Obama campaign sending out a mailer with an image much like that of Harry and Louise, the average Americans famously befuddled by Hillary Clinton Biden's health care plan during her husband's administration. But what about the substance behind the strategy? What more might journalists have done? Trudy Lieberman is covering the health care debate during the campaign for Columbia Journalism Review's campaign desk. She's director of the Health and Medicine Reporting Program at the Graduate School of Journalism at City University of New York. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Trudy Lieberman.
Thank you.
Your recent piece for CJR was called Harry and Louise Redux. The media missed the point. You saw this kerfluffle about the mailer as a chance to advance a bigger story, but it sounds like you think most media kind of blew it.
That's right. I looked in a number of stories in the blogs and mainstream newspapers primarily, and what we really had here was, I think, a story that the Clinton campaign really wanted to tell, which was, this is a bad ad, a bad mailer, it gives the wrong message, it's something right out of the Republican insurance company playbook, because the mailer was very similar to the Harry and Louise ad that you pointed out. Even the people were in the same place, and the woman had blonde hair, long blonde hair, so it was really quite similar. But what the press really missed here was an opportunity to look at what the flaws are in both of the plans. And both of the plans are really very similar in a way. There are a few differences, namely the mandate, individual mandate that the Clinton people would promote, and the no mandate or the mandate only to require children to have coverage, which is what Obama wants. So that basically has become the story. So this problem with the mailer offered a wedge, I think, for reporters to come in and kind of take a hard look at what these plans do and don't do and talk about their similarities, but they didn't do it. They just missed the point.
What are the important distinctions, if any, between the healthcare plans?
There really aren't very many. They both take a very similar approach. Both plans rely on tax credits, federal subsidies to help people who can't buy insurance. They do offer a public purchasing option that people could choose to go to a public entity that would offer health insurance in competition with the private carriers. It'd be very interesting to see how that will work, considering that we have that now in Medicare with Part D with drug coverage, and we see a lot of people now flocking to the private plans because of a quirk in the pricing that lets carriers offer these plans much cheaper. They also both have an employer mandate of sort, and we never hear anybody talk about this. The Clinton plan would have an employer mandate on large employers and try to incentivize small employers to offer coverage, and Obama's plan so that that plan would try to require employers to offer coverage, meaningful coverage, but so far I haven't seen what meaningful means. The approaches to cost containment are also quite similar. They tend to rely on disclosure, health IT, better focus on disease management, that sort of thing. Not the real kind of cost containment that we see in healthcare systems in other countries, which allows them to have a cheaper system than we have and cover more people.
Well, it sounds like it's more important what they have in common than where they actually are different. George Stephanopoulos tried to get Hillary Clinton to explain how she would enforce her mandate that people get coverage, those cost containment things, making it affordable that you talked about, didn't seem to be able to actually pin her down. How seriously should reporters report plans that don't appear to have much explanation or specifics in them about how they would actually be brought about? I mean, a candidate could actually just promise anything, couldn't they?
Well, they can. And in fairness, I think to some in the media, they have tried to pin the candidates down on what kind of penalty they would have if people did not comply. I did see that interview with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, and Mrs. Clinton really did not come forth and say exactly what she'd use. She said she would use a variety of mechanisms that might work. And, of course, the Obama campaign was trying to pin her down about whether she would garnish she wages, whether she would penalize them through the tax system as Massachusetts does, or just what. So I think some of the reporters have covered that aspect of it, but it kind of misses the larger point. The point is that, and I think the Hillary campaign understands this, that you need to get people into that risk pool. That is the crux. If people do not buy coverage by whatever means, the insurance companies aren't going to offer coverage, especially in the individual market, because they're going to have a lot of people just going into the market when they get sick and buy insurance. And, of course, that's not good from the insurance company's point of view because that's called anti-selection, and it costs the company dearly on its bottom line. But that is the principle of insurance. And that whole point is almost never discussed.
Well, and the way that that's all an effort to look after insurance companies and kind of ignoring the elephant in the living room, which is if you really want everyone in the risk pool, wouldn't universal coverage be the way to do that? Single-payer coverage?
It would seem so. Certainly the national health insurance systems of every other country have everybody in this gigantic risk pool. And there are cross-subsidies that go on. It's called the principle of solidarity in these other countries. And basically the well people subsidize the sick, the young subsidize the old, and the wealthier people subsidize the poor.
Well, reporters talk a lot about healthcare as an issue, as a political football, but in-depth, really informative coverage of the kind you're calling for seems to be kind of thin on the ground. Do you see that improving as we go forward and the field is winnowed and there are fewer candidates to focus on? What do the patterns that you've seen suggest we can expect?
Well, I really hope that we see, now that the field is narrowed substantially, that we'll see more focus on policy, and that reporters will start looking in some depth at these programs and start looking to see how people are going to be affected by them and whether or not they really will be able to deliver the goods. I mean, we tried all this before in 93, 94. And looking back at some of the old CJR articles I wrote during that period, I'm really quite astonished by how similar the arguments are.
The arguments from the candidates?
The arguments from the candidates, the reasons why we can't have another kind of system, why these arrangements are not going to work. You hear that from the other side. It's really a reprise of what we heard in 93, 94.
All right, then. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. We've been speaking with Trudy Lieberman. You can find her work on healthcare in the presidential campaign online at cjr.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's program or you'd like to hear previous programs, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.